From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. This is our daily look at the cultural life of Atlanta and the artists and creative minds behind it. Today, we're thinking of the things that bring us together and make us human. For ages, breaking bread with others has been a way to connect, to love, and to understand. New York Times food writer Kim Severson will join us to talk about how we learn to taste. First this hour, we'll be thinking about the impact that nearly a century and a half of Jewish benevolence has had on the South. We've been talking about nonprofits here on City Lights, and in the past 2 weeks, we've covered a number of arts organizations making the move to a 501c3 status. On the flip side of that, the oldest nonprofit in Georgia is 141 years old. And it's being honored right now with an exhibition at the Bremen Museum of Jewish Heritage. The exhibition is called The Legacy of the Hebrew Orphan's Home, Educating the Jewish South Since 1876. It looks at the history of the Atlanta Jewish community and the roots of Jewish benevolence in the South. Joining us now, the exhibit's curator, Professor Catherine Lewis of Kennesaw State University, and Jeremy Katz, the director of the Cuba Family Archives at the Bremen. Welcome.
Thank you Lois. So much for having us, Lois.
As anything that has been around for almost a century and a half, what began as the Hebrew Orphan's Home evolved over time. Where does the story of this organization begin?
Well, Lois, it's actually quite an interesting story. It starts in 1876, which you think not so far from the Civil War. Atlanta was a very different place than it is today. And it really begins with the B'nai B'rith District 5. And I'll let Jeremy tell the story of Simon Wolf. He's the big personality here.
Simon Wolf is really the engine behind this, the fruition of this organization. He was a businessman, a lawyer, who was very involved with B'nai B'rith. And he saw a need. There was a lot of immigrants that had come to America at this time. And you have to realize that this is a time when life expectancy isn't that great. I mean, modern medicine is not advanced that far. And so there was a lot of orphans and people that just have fallen on hard times. It's not a picture of nectar. It's a very loved ones have passed away or caregivers have passed away. And so there are a lot of orphans in the community. And he saw a need for an orphanage in the Southeast. And so he called on the B'nai B'rith District 5, which is the five states in the Southeast, to have a competition to see who could raise the most money for an orphanage in their city. And Atlanta won that competition.
And it's no surprise that that it would be Atlanta. Of course, on the eve of the Civil War, there were only 50 Jews in the city, but that grew exponentially. And we had some big personalities that came forward. And when the competition began, as Jeremy described, the Jewish community came together and raised $62,000 almost overnight.
I can only imagine what that must have amounted to in 1876. The population grew from around 50 during the Civil War to how many 10, 12 years later?
By about 1876, it's closer to 200, 280. The records aren't great, Jeremy. I think that's something we always talk about.
Reconstruction was such a booming interesting time for Atlanta. A lot of Jews were driven to the community because they saw the economic opportunity. This is when you have someone like Morris Rich come to Atlanta. He founded Rich's department store in 1867, which grew into the largest department store in the Southeast. You have Jacob Ellis come to Atlanta and found the Fulton Bag and Cotton Mill, which became the largest employer in Atlanta and formed Cabbage Town. And these were both people that were very, very philanthropic. And so they were one of the major donors to this project.
And as you pointed out, Jeremy, with modern medicine, we forget as we listen to phrases like 70 is the new 50, just how short the life expectancy was around the turn of the last century and nearly 150 years before. And there were so many children who had lost both parents by a very young age. Where was the original orphan's home?
It was on Washington Street, 478 Washington Street, which was really the heart of the Jewish community. A lot of the synagogues were on Washington Street. Businesses were close by. Neighborhoods were close by. And you hear these wonderful stories of actually children in the neighborhood coming to the orphanage because they had a baseball diamond. They had a tennis court. They had a skating rink. They had a merry-go-round. And so it really was a meeting ground for the local Jewish community. And you hear these amazing stories of how the children really didn't feel as though they weren't separate from the community. They weren't forced to wear uniforms. They went to public schools. They were taught very important life skills. They had remedial classes after school where they learned how to type. They learned shorthand. They learned how plumbing. They learned how to keep track of accounting books, those types of very real life skills so that they could take those skills after they graduated and apply them to be self-sustaining.
Vocational skills. Does the building still exist?
Sadly, it doesn't. And it was a beautiful building. When you come to the Bremen, you'll see we have a lovely series of photographs, and we've done a giant mural that shows this beautiful terracotta building that really dominated the landscape. It was modern, certainly for that time, and the children, as Jeremy described, the facilities really were quite extraordinary. It opens in 1889, and that's just about the time when the orphan's home was chartered separately from B'nai B'rith. So B'nai B'rith helped get it started, and then it became its own entity. And it stays open until 1930. So you start to see changes in child welfare. But the orphanage, by all accounts, was a model throughout the nation, not just an amazing place in the city.
So much has been written about the emergence of social service agencies and reformers around the turn of the last century. Jane Addams Hull House in Chicago. For orphans in New York, I read that beginning in 1853, there was something called the New York Juvenile Asylum, which was later known as the Children's Village. Organizations were formed in northern cities that were religion-based, Catholic homes for Irish immigrants in various cities, for example. Please tell us about the specific need within the southern Jewish community that the home served.
Sure. And you described exactly what happened, that before state and federal governments took responsibility for social services, it really was the religious community and the philanthropic community that filled the gap. So in Atlanta, we of course have the orphanage, but there was also the Methodist Children's Home and the Baptist Children's Home. Many of these communities came together. But it was needed. There was no safety net. In 1876, if you had been orphaned and didn't have family, extended family, you were largely on your own. And that would have been a very difficult phenomena. And certainly when we look at the children who were in the orphan's home over those 30 years, it wasn't just that they had lost both parents. In some cases, they may have only lost one, but a parent couldn't care for the child for a whole host of reasons. But you talked about, maternal death rates were very common. Childhood was a dangerous enterprise in the 19th and early 20th century. So the Jewish community came together, recognized that, and was on the forefront of creating the home. And you're absolutely right that there were national conversations. Teddy Roosevelt convened in 1909 a conference about this very topic, and the children's home would have been very aware of that.
We will talk more about that in just a moment. If you are just joining us, we're here with Professor Catherine Lewis and Jeremy Katz discussing a new exhibition at the Bremen Museum looking at the history of the Jewish Educational Loan Fund. We'll be back after a short break on City Lights.
Support for WABE comes from Half Price Books, offering book lovers a broad selection of titles including current releases, bestsellers, collectibles, even textbooks. More at neighborhood Half Price bookstores or online at hpb.com. And from Peachtree Hearing in Marietta, Georgia. Dr. Melissa Wyckoff offers diagnosis and treatment for hearing loss, ringing in the ears, and dizziness or vertigo. More information online at peachtreehearing.com.
Listening to City Lights on WABE, we're back with Jeremy Katz and Catherine Lewis here telling us about a new exhibition, The Legacy of the Hebrew Orphans Home, at the Bremen Museum in Midtown. President Teddy Roosevelt had to do with the next stage of the organization's growth. What led to the home closing down?
Well, certainly the world changes, and the commitment to social services in the early 20th century from the progressive reformers, Lois, that you mentioned, modeled on things like Hull House and just a conversation about how can we better serve our youth. So when Teddy Roosevelt convened a White House conference on these very issues, it would have trickled down to many of these orphanages.
And what year, excuse me, Catherine, what year was that?
1909 is when he pulls the committee together, but there had certainly been plenty of conversations before that. And so they started talking about, are we serving the community in the way that we should? Are we still seeing the same kind of children coming, and are we meeting their needs? And they started talking about doing more welfare placements, foster care, a sort of deinstitutionalizing children. That became a movement in the early 20th century. And that's what led to ultimately the closing down. But Jeremy might have a few things to add to that.
Yeah, certainly so. It's such an interesting story to see that this was a movement across the entire country, where you see this move away from institutionalizing young children, heading more towards what Catherine mentioned, growing up in a family unit, having that support of a mother and a father, siblings, even if it's foster care. They thought that was a much better way of children growing up in society. And that was just the worldview at the time. And this is a story about this organization adapting to the changing needs and the changing of the community, and adapting to those needs and growing within those needs.
Were there any children who were in the care of the Hebrew Orphans Home who later became well known?
There certainly are many stories about that. One major story is Al Garber. He was one of the orphanage orphans who was helped by the orphanage, and he learned how to become an accountant by taking some of the bookkeeping classes that were vocational classes that were offered by the home. He was one of the first that were offered a interest-free loan to go to college through the orphanage. Went to the University of Georgia and then became an accountant and grew into one of the largest accounting firms in the Southeast.
So interest-free loans, the emphasis on education and higher education, this was a foundation for what we now know as...
as JELF.
JELF, the acronym for Jewish Educational Loan Foundation. What will visitors to the Bremen see at this exhibition? You mentioned the photograph and the mural of the beautiful home itself. What else will visitors take in?
The Bremen has such an amazing, we're very fortunate to have such an amazing collection related to the orphanage and the many Jewish Children's Services and JELF as the organization has morphed over the years. We are the home of their records. And so this exhibition really started as a couple of cases and grew into an entire gallery because of all the materials we have at the Bremen. We have everything from photographs to artifacts. We mentioned earlier some actual bricks from the building itself. So really fantastic objects that tell this story over as it has changed over the years.
So the Blonder Gallery, which is the main gallery at the Bremen, you'll walk in and you'll be amazed by both the beauty of the exhibition. We've chosen the terracotta to echo the building. So it's a very warm and inviting space. And so as you come in, you'll see the mural. You'll see two films, a short film that talks about JELF and how current recipients have been impacted by the loans, and a longer film that tells the whole history. You'll see a 10-panel part of the exhibition that tells the story from 1876 to the present, and that piece of the exhibition will actually go on to travel after the exhibit closes in January. We curated it to have a traveling component.
Where will it go?
Throughout the five-state region that JELF serves, so we're really excited about that. And then, as Jeremy described, there are artifacts, Sadaka boxes, which would be charity boxes that were placed at various temples to raise money for JELF, and documents and photographs. But then also you'll have a chance to see scrapbooks that we've created from documents from the Bremen collection. And there's a Jelfy station, which we laugh about, that you can step up onto a platform and take a photograph to celebrate JELF and its long history. And we close the exhibition with what we call the Wall of Gratitude. That part of the collection at the Bremen is filled with thank you notes from almost the very beginning of the history of JELF, where students talk about the impact of the orphanage, of Jewish Children's Services, which is its sort of second phase, and then ultimately JELF. And the theme of education is, I would say, if Jeremy and I had kind of a theme that we wove through the exhibition, it would be this thread of education, the importance of it within the Jewish community, and the power of philanthropy to make those opportunities available to the children who were served. The other piece of the story that has surprised us, and I think it's why the exhibition grew and grew, is that there's very much a sort of theme of kind of taking it full circle. JELF has this wonderful way of serving students, and those students come back and serve JELF.
If I could quickly add to that, some of the most important research requests that we get, and a large number of research requests, come from descendants of those that were interned at the house, and they want to learn about their family and how they wound up in Atlanta and how this organization assists them, because that affects how they grew up and in their upbringing. And I get researchers that come in that are just bawling and weeping and reading through their family file.
Yes, so there's the genealogical aspect as well. Jeremy Katz is curator of the Cuba Family Archives at the Bremen Museum. Professor Catherine Lewis is curator of the exhibit, The Legacy of the Hebrew Orphans Home, on view now at the Bremen, which is located at 1440 Spring Street in Midtown Atlanta. There will be a grand opening event at the museum on Thursday, August 24th. Jeremy, Catherine, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Lois.
We enjoyed it. Thank you, Lois.
Support for WABE comes from the Fresh Market, offering a refreshed store experience with premium meat, seasonal produce, signature baked goods, and meals to go. Learn more at thefreshmarket.com/refresh.
Blues singer and guitarist Buddy Guy plays the Atlanta Botanical Garden on Friday, August 25th. WABE is giving away 2 tickets for the concert next Friday evening at 8. You may win those if you call us at 678-686-0367. For full contest rules, visit wabe.org/support/sweepstakes. Good luck. This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening. It's time to check in on the latest local arts and culture headlines with producer Aaron Wright and ArtsATL.com executive editor Laura Relier. Here's Aaron.
First up today is some difficult news for the Atlanta arts scene. This past Friday night, there was a reported altercation at the High Museum's teen night. Laura, what details do we know?
You know, this is hard. As an arts reporter, I don't find myself pulling police reports very often, but here we are. Arts ATL still has a story in development. We're in the process of interviewing eyewitnesses and going through reports from the evening. But what we do know was that there was an altercation involving a teenager and an Atlanta police officer on campus after the teen night.
You're saying we don't know much yet. How has the community reacted?
Confused and a bit shocked, honestly, especially during such a volatile weekend nationally. I mean, teen night is a longstanding and until this point successful tradition at the High Museum. And like I said, Arts ATL will report more thoroughly on this later in the week, and I'd be happy to fill you in then. As of our recording deadline, all we have is an eyewitness account published on Medium and a statement issued by the High Museum.
Okay, we'll check back in with you next week at the latest.
Sure. In the meantime, let's talk about this year's Working Artist Project winners from the Museum of Contemporary Art of Georgia.
Right. For those unfamiliar, this is the 10th year of MoCA GA's annual Working Artist Project. This award gives 3 artists $15,000 each, a solo show, a student assistant, and a lot more.
It's really an incredible opportunity for mid-career and established artists here in Atlanta.
And who are this year's recipients?
Bojana Ginn, Mitchie Migo, and Kirsten Mitchell.
And there's another big visual arts announcement coming up just around the corner.
It's true. The finalists of the Hudgens Prize will open their group exhibition this weekend, and they'll be announcing the winner of the prize on September 30th.
And this is the big one, a $50,000 grant and a solo exhibition at the Hudgens Center for the Arts. City Lights will speak with finalist Jiha Moon on tomorrow's show, but remind me, who are the other finalists?
Cosmo White, Sarah Hobbs, and Lori Stallings.
Great. Last up, Darren Wong, co-founder of the AJC Decatur Book Festival, is stepping away from the organization after this year's festivities.
It's true. After 12 years of getting the DBF off the ground and growing it into one of the largest independent book festivals in the country, he's taking some well-earned time off to focus on his creative pursuits,
which include his own debut novel, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires.
Yes, and that comes with a very ambitious tour after Darren launches the novel at the Decatur Book Festival, which is very suiting.
And with Darren Wong's departure, what's next for the DBF?
The board is putting together a transition team to help plan the next steps for the festival as it moves forward. But Julie Wilson's been doing a good job the past couple years, and it's in good hands.
We look forward to hearing more about that. Laura Relier, as always, thank you so much for bringing us the latest arts and culture headlines.
Thanks for having me.
She is the executive editor of artsatl.com.
Support for WABE comes from Fellows Labriola, a law firm devoted exclusively to the representation of clients in complex litigation in state and federal courts. Fellows Labriola, online at fellab.com.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. In just a moment, New York Times food writer Kim Severson joins us. Television shows like Stranger Things and movies like The Avengers have showcased not only Georgia's landscape, but also some actors from the Atlanta area. So are we becoming the new Hollywood for young actors? Aditi Bundla Moody finds out.
So, did you call?
Keep your voice down.
Did he?
That's Shannon Purser, who plays Barb on the hit Netflix show Stranger Things. She grew up in Roswell and goes to Kennesaw State.
To have an opportunity where I could literally just get in my car and drive 30 minutes to work and, you know, go act and then come home and be in my own bed was really kind of like the perfect scenario.
Purser says the proximity allowed her to finish high school, too, something she wouldn't have been able to do if she moved out to Los Angeles. Kiana Simone Simpson spent time in L.A. too, but it wasn't until she came back to Decatur that she started booking acting jobs, like her role in the HBO movie The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, starring Oprah Winfrey. She says even the audition process is different.
In L.A., I will say that, you know, when you go into the auditions, everyone's pretty used to it. No one's really talking to each other. You go in and you do your thing. In Atlanta, everyone knows each other.
Isabella Amara, who was most recently in Spider-Man Homecoming, says the actor community in Georgia is small but tight-knit. She says it comes from the fact that for a while, film studios only went to New York and LA for actors.
Georgia was the first place to break the barrier. And that's why we're so helpful with each other and we're always so loving because we want all of us to succeed. We want everyone in here to show everywhere else, you know, we can be as good as you too.
Amara says the industry is growing in Atlanta and the actor pool is growing denser by the day. She says, if anything, actors are now coming to Georgia for their big break, not to Hollywood. Aditi Bandlamudi, WABE News.
Support for WABE comes from Ackerman Security, providing custom-designed smart home security systems with remote access as well as video surveillance, fire protection, and monitored entry alarms to protect your home and business. Ackerman, the sign of real security. And from High Meadows School. Center for Progressive Learning is hosting a panel on the role of social justice in education, Wednesday, August 23rd. Included are author Andrew Iden of the novel series March. Info at highmeadowscenter.org.
You're listening to City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Starkist Tuna used to have animated TV commercials with character Charlie the Tuna. They'd put him in a situation like visiting an art museum and someone would ask him what on earth a fish was doing at an art museum. And he was trying to show Starkist that he had good taste. The punchline was, "Sorry, Charlie, Starkist doesn't want tuna with good taste. They want tuna that tastes good." When it comes to matters of taste, Kim Severson is quite an expert. The Atlanta-based writer for the New York Times joins us in studio now. Kim, welcome back to City Lights.
I'm so glad to be here. So I am, in fact, your Charlie Tuna here for the day.
No, you have good taste. And I don't want to say you taste good because I don't want to bite you.
You don't know yet. We're just starting this relationship, so thank you.
There are people who have never read Marcel Proust's writings, but are aware of what's known as the Proustian moment. In your memoir, Spoon-Fed, you wrote about how when you became a food critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, you had to really think hard about describing what you like to eat and why you like to eat it. It was not something as easy as one would think. And something that complicated the task is what you call taste memory. What is taste memory?
Well, you think about benchmarks in your childhood or something you really, really love to eat. I mean, it could be a chicken wing. It could be the best lemon pepper chicken wing you ever had. Or it could be, you know, the most perfect little strawberry you ever had. Or it could be that first vanilla ice cream cone you had with your dad when you were a kid. So you remember that vanilla. It was probably really creamy and cold. It was probably hot when you were eating it. And you were with a parent, or you were in a place where you felt something inside. So you mingle in your mind all these great tastes, right? And probably it wasn't the best vanilla ice cream you ever had. It probably maybe was a little more chemically enhanced than you might like. So, but you mark that in your brain as what vanilla ice cream should taste like. So then you go through life and, you know, eventually somebody makes you fresh vanilla ice cream with real cream. Your palate hopefully has been a little expanded. You're grown up and you really taste, you know, vanilla ice cream just made with cream and sugar, maybe with egg, with some real vanilla bean. And you just think, oh, this is what it was trying to do. I'll give you an example. When I first moved to New York, people had Concord grape pie and real Concord grapes, which I'd never tasted, like actual Concord grapes. And the first one I tasted, I thought, this is what grape bubblegum was trying to do.
Exactly. I remember that. The first time I tasted a Concord grape, we were visiting family in L.A., and they served them. And I thought, oh, grape lollipops, which were always my favorite flavor. And who knew? I mean, this Chicagoan didn't know from Concord grapes.
Right. But didn't that just change it? So now when you taste grape soda, you're like, oh, nice try. I've tasted the real Concord grape. But it did taste exactly like that flavor. So, and you know, so taste memory matters. And it matters because we want to have pleasure when we eat. That's why we eat. And, you know, we are so separated from all the pleasures that come with sitting at a table and eating food and thinking about it and food that grows in the earth. You know, all of this was sort of dismissed as elitist thought for a while. You had, you know, President Obama was, when he was running for office, he was the arugula president. We had the latte liberals. The idea of good food, I think, has become politically divisive a little in this country. But increasingly, that idea of eating and tasting and being thoughtful and community is coming back in vogue in a big way. It's partially why there's farm to table. Certainly our young millennial friends will tell you that eating with somebody now makes a big difference in such a digital world. Food is the most analog experience you can have, right? So taste and sharing and where food comes from, I think, is more culturally significant now than it ever has been. But you have to know what you like. You have to know what tastes good to you and why it's giving you pleasure. And that's where that taste memory comes in.
I think it's admirable that you do not come across as a snob, as a food snob. Because, Kim, I think some people can feel intimidated by the modern food movement. And yet, what you're saying is don't discount what you associate with sweet memories of taste and all that conjures up, but also recognize that there is an ideal for that. And an example in your memoir was you talked about Hershey's chocolate.
Oh, right. So, you know, you remember Hershey's chocolate, that chocolate kiss maybe, and there's something about that. Now, if you start to taste chocolates and you really start to spend some time, you put eight different kinds of chocolates in front of you and you talk to somebody who explains to you why that chocolate needs to melt at a certain temperature in your mouth, and you start to taste those really well-done chocolates, your palate changes. So then when you go back to that Hershey's chocolate, it tastes kind of sour and sort of waxy. However, I will say I can mess up some Hershey's Kisses because I still, and I think I remember them in a little bowl on the table in my mother's house. And there's something about that taste memory. And sometimes, you know, crappy food is kind of fun if you like it. I have a thing for Jack in the Box tacos. Now out here, there are no Jack in the Boxes, but there's something about those crazy little greasy fried Jack in the Box tacos. And my old editor at the San Francisco Chronicle shared my secret affection for them. And we would sneak out. We would be at the San Francisco Chronicle in the test kitchen tasting all this great food. And she and I would sneak out and get a Jack in the Box taco every once in a while because really bad food done really well is kind of great sometimes. So I think it's about taste, you know, and as long as you're sort of thoughtful about why you like something, you're not just mindlessly shoving stuff into your mouth, which we do because we're all so busy and there it is. And you're just going to have this disappointing, sad little, you know, desk lunch. But the more thoughtful we are about things, the better. And if that thing is not a fancy schmancy thing, I think that's okay.
I'm intrigued with bad food done really well.
Okay, tell me your food secret, Lois. What's a secret thing that you wouldn't want to tell anybody in your vast listening audience that you like to eat secretly when you're alone?
Peanut butter out of a jar.
Oh, nice. That's a good, now crunchy or smooth?
No, crunchy. It's got to be crunchy.
Oh, okay. All right.
And what are some other?
A spoon or just you just get in there with your finger?
That's not bad either. But see, I also tell myself, this is protein. And then I think about George Washington Carver, and I think the peanut is a good thing.
This is a historically significant moment,
yes.
Me here in my underwear with my finger in the peanut butter jar.
So
fantastic.
Finish half of the jar. You know, why not? I like what you mentioned about the pacing, but now that I think of it, you put it back to me. I want to hear more about bad food. Well done.
The tables have turned here, Ms. Reitzes.
Okay. This would take me back to Chicago hot dogs.
Oh,
and
you're
don't
never
going to
let me forget
there.
About
no.
The hot dogs, right?
No, I won't. We will not go there.
I will point out that Alice Waters, who I just recently interviewed that got us talking about this idea of taste, she's the California chef from Chez Panisse, was just in the Chicago airport, and she was looking for a Chicago hot dog. She found an organic one somewhere.
Please.
And...
Really?
And sent it out and said she was experiencing this. So even Alice Waters was trying to find the authentic Chicago hot dog experience. But you don't think it's an organic hot dog?
No, I can tell Alice that if she wants authentic, you know, there are more than 2,000 hot dog stands, which in Chicago you call a hot dog joint, in
really?
The metropolitan.
The Wiener Circle? The Winner Circle? Have you been there? That's the only one that I really know, and I it's just a little divey place in Chicago.
Flukies is the
one. Oh, is that the one?
My family go. Okay. Anyway, I'm not going to drag you through that again. If you're just joining us, this is City Lights. New York Times food writer Kim Severson is our guest today, and we're talking about taste, our evolving palates. Charlie the Tuna, and after a short break, Kim is going to tell us more about one of her mentors, Chef Alice Waters. You're listening to WABE, Atlanta's Choice for NPR.
She sells seashells by the seashore, but I know a gal who sells so much more. Queenie Wahine's papaya rates higher than pineapple, pumpkin, or poi. Please pick her papaya with Queenie Wahine in perfect perpetual joy. Though some people's palates prefer pickled salads, plum pudding, pink popcorn, peach pie. Oh, Queenie's papaya, you'll truly desire when that Queenie Wahine passes by. Queenie Wahine's papaya rates higher.
Support for WABE comes from Rosie's Roofing and Restoration, committed to keeping you cozy and dry regardless of the weather. Rosie's Roofing and Restoration, there when you need us, online at roesiesroofing.com. And from Children's Museum of Atlanta, presenting Blue Man Group Making Waves through September 4th. You can discover the art and science behind music during this multi-sensory exploration of sound. Grandparent memberships available. Childrensmuseumatlanta.org.
We're back with City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes here with New York Times food writer and friend of the show, Kim Severson. Her next piece in the New York Times will be about her mentor, Alice Waters. Before we talk about Alice, Kim, I was hoping to go back to something you were saying a moment ago about how we experience taste in relation to the tempo of our lives. I am guilty of eating sandwiches while stopped at red lights in my car and feeling accomplished because look at the multitasking I'm doing. How can focusing on taste help us pace ourselves better?
I think taste relates to culture and to how you live your life. So I too have had to do that in the car, and every time that my child is in the back seat eating something because we're rushing to another event, I feel a little piece of me dies inside because I think this is not how I want to experience my life and live my life. So I like to slow it down and spend a lot of time on what I eat every day. Now, I know we're all busy and we all cram things in. It's the American, way. But let's think about what we lose if we don't sit down at least for one meal of the day with the people that are in our family or that we love, or even with ourselves. Judith Jones, who was the great cookbook editor, she just died recently, and she was the one who edited Julia Child's cookbook. She's the one who pulled the Anne Frank diaries out of the slush pile, and she's was just a titan in cookbook editing. But her last book was Cooking for One. So her husband had died, but she still would sit every day and make a good meal for herself, set the place at the table, and care for herself with food. So, there's so much we learn at the table, right? The culture of the table. You learn if there's not enough, a salad in the bowl for everybody at the table, you take a little bit less because you're caring for the person next to you. You learn to pass things. You learn to converse, and you do that all around the table. And if we lose that culture of eating together, a lot of social fabric, I think, fades away. Plus, it's just, again, it's back to what tastes good, what's pleasurable. I eat because it's pleasurable. And it can be on the high end, and I've eaten at the very highest end, and it can be on the low end with my Jack in the Box taco. But when I would go get that Jack in the Box taco with my editor and we had our little shared moment, that was something. So eating, fitting food into our lives, I know is a challenge, but maybe it's just making sure that you make something in the morning to take to work that you actually like, as opposed to just trying to scrounge around and eat whatever you can get to on the road. It's being just a little bit more thoughtful, and I think it pays off so much. We're not talking about having to make multi-course meals every day, but it's just being mindful about where you are when you're eating what you're eating. I think that makes a big difference.
And I know that Alice Waters was so greatly influenced by youthful trips she took to France and, just seeing how people dined. In France, people don't eat, they dine. I mean, do not plan on spending less than 2 hours sitting at a table.
It's true. And if you ever want to know how you're not doing something right, you just spend a little bit of time with Alice Waters, which has been my experience. But I also think that she's 73 now and has been unwavering in her devotion to the table, to organic, to the point where people parody her and I think make a lot of fun of her for it. But now she's 73. Her restaurant, Chez Panisse, is 46 years old. And I just ate two meals there. And let me tell you, it is still a great, great, great restaurant, one of the best in the country. But when you get the food, you think, well, okay, this is a pluot, as a little, a pluot and some strawberries and some meringue for dessert. And you think, this is the best restaurant in the country. But then you taste that pluot from, you know, that has come from Frog Hollow Farms, and it is the most delicious expression of that fruit you would ever have, and you can just taste, you know, California in it, and it truly is remarkable. And you think, oh, okay, this is something special. Now, it's a lot of people give her a hard time and say what she does is shopping, not cooking
or curating,
right? Or curating, but you know, she could curate my dinner every night.
Well,
you know,
she was truly a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. So Berkeley,
and still
California.
Right.
Really? Now, how so? You were just with her. She's 73.
She's amazing. And her thing is universal, sustainable, organic school lunch, free for every child in the country. And that lunch is tied into education. And that's all she, I mean, she is, you know, you're 73, you think you could kick it a little, but no, she is just dedicated to that. And her idea is that you could use that lunch, say you're learning about Mexico, you would use that lunch and you would have a tamale and you would have some beans and they would have come from a certain garden and the kids would have gone out and measured the garden as part of their math class, and this idea of edible education.
Which Michelle Obama, First
right.
Lady Michelle Obama, embraced.
Right, and which Alice told me, Michelle pulled her aside once and said, you were my inspiration. So, you know, there were certainly a lot of people who helped, you know, when the federal government was more interested in that with Michelle Obama, that, you know, were influenced. But one thing I liked about the story that I wrote for the Times, it'll be out early next week, was about a new memoir she wrote called Coming to My Senses. But it was really her early years up through the French period she had when she was backpacking around Europe and eating amazing cheeses and foods on a backpacker's budget, and back when you could do that in the 60s. And having very many, the book is full of a lot of great sexual adventures, which it's a bit like learning that your grandmother was at an orgy, but I'm just warning people.
Appetites and appetites.
Right. Thank you very much. But it is really interesting because she came of age during the free speech movement. And I think food was exploding then in America. It was about to. We were still in the continental French restaurant period. That's what defined fine dining to us. The snotty sommelier and the, you know, Duc L'Orange and the, you know. So we were just busting out of that. Nobody really thought that you could buy, you know, when you went to a restaurant to have sole, you would have sole from England, right? And the idea of that California petrol sole, the local sole from California, nobody valued that. And she and the group of cooks of her generation started to say, you know, we are growing some great stuff in America. So it broke us from that European, you know, the strict European definition of fine dining. So it was a really interesting period, and a period of great revolt politically. There's some parallels now, I think, with what's happening. So it was interesting to hear her take on that and the food system as we know it now.
What is her take on the food system?
She says it's really not the time to be pushing against the government or expect the USDA to fix our food system, that the large food corporations, and this is her view, large food corporations are so tied in with government and the system is so corrupt that there's really no way to make food healthier and better if we're going to rely on government regulation, because they're greatly influenced by the food companies that are invested in more processed foods. So she says it's like we're in the French Resistance. We're just at the period where we're all passing notes to each other. There will be an uprising. It will happen, but it's not the time to happen now. We all just need to take care of each other, pass our notes. And she's got a very counterculture French Resistance approach to what's happening now. I was waiting for her to pass me a note so I knew when the next, you know. So that's kind of her perspective, is we could waste a lot of energy pushing against what's happening on a federal level, or we could really drill down into community right now. So that's her take on how to approach our current political state.
That is fascinating, because on the one hand, it's so in sync with, you know, a 60s Berkeley-based revolutionary, and yet it's also a little libertarian.
It is very interesting. I feel like making dinner for my neighbor now would be the biggest political act I could do.
Interesting.
So I challenge all of Atlanta to go and find somebody that they perhaps are not, they don't know well, or someone in their neighborhood, and invite them over and roast a chicken and just have a community dinner. I think that's what we all should be doing right now. I challenge you, Atlanta, make dinner for somebody you don't know so well.
I think that's a marvelous idea. Or people you know well and love.
Also that.
Thinking about your daughter in the back seat, when you sit down to dinner together, is it as important to you what you are talking about as what's before you, or how do they relate to each other?
One thing that matters to me is my daughter's 9, so she can make a good vinaigrette. She can do a couple little things.
Does she eat peanut butter out of the jar?
She's not a huge peanut butter fan. And if I can take a side trip on the peanut butter issue, I think the peanut butter allergy issue has created an entire generation of children who don't like peanut butter very much because they haven't eaten it that much. Yeah. I mean, I grew up eating lots of peanut butter and jelly.
It was the default
lunch.
Loved
it. Yeah, and sometimes I still, like you, get that urge just for peanut butter. But my daughter and her friends are not big peanut butter fans, I think only because they had to go to school without peanut butter sandwiches. So I think one, and as we're learning more about peanut allergies and figuring out how to deal with it, I think one fallout is that we have the peanut butter and jelly sandwich as the icon of childhood is going away. Again, a side trip. So when we sit down to eat, what do? Well, setting the table, making sure we sit down together, having her toss the salad, those little pieces matter a lot to me because I feel like she's connecting at the table. And we have a couple games. We play the question game where you can ask anyone at the table anything and they have to tell you the truthful answer. It's sort of like a family-friendly version of Truth or Dare.
Yes.
Just gets her to ask questions, and then whoever gets ask the question gets to ask the next one. We play Rose and Thorn. So we say, what was your one thorn? What was the worst thing about your day? And what was the best thing?
Oh, I know the Obamas did that too.
Yeah, and all of that helps that conversation. But I'm into food, so we're eating something. I'm talking about, oh, look, we got this from the farmer's market. Or, the other day I had a bunch of big pork roast that I had, and we had some leftovers, so we made them into tacos, and we're doing a taco bar, and could just shred that up, and we had a little bit of lettuce we crunched up, and some, I think we had some, tortillas from the grocery store, and it was fun, and we just sort of made food and mostly talked about what we were going to have for dessert, or if we were going to be allowed to have dessert. That's the whole dessert thing's a challenge, because I really enjoy dessert, and I don't want to just feed my child giant bowls of ice cream. I don't think that's a very good parenting move either. But
no, but just vinaigrette does not make for childhood memories.
No, she doesn't want to grow. Because then she's going to write a memoir about me. I'll be embarrassed. She'll be, I only ate vinaigrette as a child. The Vinaigrette Chronicles. I'll get a call from Child Protective Services. Your child has only been eating vinaigrette. This whole thing could be terrible. You're right. Thank you for pointing that out.
I think your family meals sound ideal. I
will have to invite you over sometime.
I would love that. New York Times food writer Kim Severson is based in Atlanta, lucky for us. Her memoir is Spoon-Fed, and her story about Alice Waters will appear in the Times.
People can check it out digitally on Tuesday, and it'll be the cover of our food section in print next Wednesday.
Kim, as always, it is a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You have been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways we express ourselves creatively. Tomorrow morning at 11, Pete Hornberger will be in the house. Comedian Scott Adsit stops by WABE. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. I'm Lois Reitzes. Follow me on Twitter at Lois Reitzes. That's LOISREITZES. Follow this station at WABE News. Thanks so much for listening to today's edition of City Lights and for tuning to member-supported 90.1 WABE. Atlanta's choice for NPR. And kudos to the producers for that fabulous Elvis Presley music about papayas and everything else you do.